You may be seated. Our final case this morning, 2019-1381, the State of Ohio versus Christopher D. Garrett. Sitting for Justice Bruner is Judge Myron Duhart from the 6th District. Thank you, Judge, for taking the place of Justice Bruner this morning. Ms. Jackson for the appellant.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Melissa Jackson, and I'm here on behalf of defendant appellate Christopher Garrett. This morning, I'm going to be focusing on the first two propositions of law in our brief, and I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Christopher Garrett had the right to a fair, reliable, individualized sentencing hearing in his capital case, but a number of serious errors undermined the fairness of those proceedings, and the resulting death sentence must be reversed. When the death penalty may be imposed, the Eighth Amendment requires a sentencer to consider the character and the record of the individual defendant, and that defendant has the right to present relevant mitigating evidence supporting a sentence less than death. Under Ohio law, a defendant has great latitude in determining what evidence to present. Here, the trial court denied Mr. Garrett that right to present the mitigation of his choosing by both instructing the jury that it must consider his mitigation evidence against the criteria of Revised Code 29-2904B3, a factor that the defense deliberately and strategically did not raise, and by failing to instruct the jury that the lack of a significant criminal record is a statutory mitigating factor, despite the evidence and argument that counsel had presented. Jury instructions must completely and correctly state the law. The jury deciding Mr. Garrett's fate was given instructions that failed on both accounts. This is not a case where the trial court simply read all of the possible mitigating factors delineated in the statute. The trial court selectively read only three of those seven factors, and one of those that he told the jury was the B3 factor, which requires consideration of the defendant's state of mind at the time of the offense. It's very similar to the language of the NGRI defense. During the culpability phase, the jury had already rejected an NGR defense as to one of the victims in the case. Defense counsel, therefore, wanted to change the focus at the mitigation hearing to focus on the powerful mitigating evidence of Mr. Garrett's entire life, his mental health being one of those factors, but his character and background, and his diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which is a serious mental illness, and that evidence had been uncontroverted during the culpability phase of the case, even by the state's own expert. This was counsel's strategic decision. This is how they wanted to present the mitigation. They had filed a motion pre-trial, which the trial court had granted to only instruct on factors raised by the defense. They informed the trial court about a week before mitigation they would not be recalling the psychological expert, Dr. Bearden, but they wanted that evidence readmitted because they wanted to focus on the psychological history, the abuse and neglect, and the reactive attachment disorder diagnosis. When defense counsel gave their opening, they made no mention of the B3 factor. In fact, they specifically emphasized to the jury that they were not raising an excuse at this point and that it was not NGRI all over again. It was only...
How is that harmful, the NGRI defense and the mental health issues that could be used for mitigating factors? One doesn't take away from the other, correct?
Well, in this case, counsel was worried that the jury would only look at the evidence through the lens of the time of the offense. And the powerful mitigating evidence, including the mental illness, that's the character and background, that's the any other factor evidence. So because they had rejected that so quickly, I think the verdict took only less than 3 hours, including lunch, for the multiple counts in the case, they thought, well, the jury isn't convinced about his state of mind at the time of the offense, but there's still all this other mitigation that needs to be considered. That's how defense counsel explained it to the trial court as to why they weren't asking for the instruction. And it's what they told the jury over and over again in closing once they knew that the instruction was going to be given, they said, well, we're worried you're going to crumple this up and throw it away because you're just going to assume it's NGRI all over again. And as this court has recognized, there's a clear difference between considering mental health and mental illness under B3 versus B7. Many cases in this court, most recently in McAlpin, in Lawson, this court has found that the evidence of mental illness, while it didn't rise to the level of being mitigating under B3, it was still powerful mitigating evidence under B7. And so that's how counsel wanted to present their case to the jury on behalf of Mr. Garrett.
Counsel, as with all jury instructions, if the record and the evidence supports the instruction on a statutory mitigating factor, the court is duty-bound to give that instruction. And so to allow, I guess, the defendant to dictate what otherwise the law would require, how do you square that?
Well, in DePue, this court has said that it's the defendant's right to choose what mitigating factors to move forward with based on the statutory language of 2904. And the trial court recognized that it didn't have to give that instruction when it granted the pretrial motion, saying that it would only instruct on factors raised by the defense. And if the case were that the trial court had to give the instruction, if the evidence supported it, they didn't give the instruction, the trial court didn't give the instruction on the lack of a prior criminal history. So if that was the court's rationale, it didn't even follow its own logic in the instructions that it gave to the jury. But overall, mitigation is the choice of the defendant. Defendants have waived mitigation. They have decided not to present certain mitigating factors. And so that's something that needed to be respected here when trial counsel was making a strategic, deliberate decision to focus the jury's attention away from the time of the offense. The trial counsel were very concerned about the risk that the jury would impose this nexus requirement. And they were right to be concerned because that's what the state argued extensively during its closing argument. Comments that the state would not have been able to make if the instruction hadn't been given. If the defense doesn't raise a factor, neither the state nor the trial court can comment on it because it's impossible to weigh a factor the defense doesn't think exists against the aggravating circumstances. So when the trial court gave the instruction, it allowed the prosecutor to basically set the defendant up to fail, to say, their evidence doesn't meet the standard of B3, and therefore you shouldn't consider it at all. They described the mental health testimony as only applying to the counts that were relevant to the NGRI defense at trial. So they tried to cabin that mental health evidence off to only refute those counts. They repeatedly talked about the time of the offense. There was no evidence that Mr. Garrett was experiencing a manic episode at the time of the offense. So again and again, the state made the argument to tie all the mitigating evidence back to the time of the offense, which they would not have been allowed to do had that instruction not been given. We can look at what the trial court did in its own opinion, considering the mental health evidence at the time. The trial court did the very thing that trial counsel were worried about and focused on the mental state at the time of the offenses and giving no weight to Dr. Reardon's testimony. The trial court never mentioned the bipolar diagnosis, which again was unrefuted during the culpability phase of the trial. So the trial court's opinion demonstrates exactly what trial counsel was worried about happening with the jury. As I said, there were other errors in the jury instructions. So when we look at the jury instructions as a whole, which we must do to see, if the jury was able to apply these in a way that violated Mr. Garrett's rights, the trial court failed to give the lack of prior criminal history instruction when there was clear evidence in the case, and where the state hadn't conceded that that was a mitigating factor. So while defense counsel argued it, the state didn't, and as in other cases before this court where the state has conceded its mitigating factor, the lack of instruction hasn't been found to be prejudicial. But here, defense counsel didn't get the benefit of having that statutory factor explained to the jury as being one of the mitigating factors. Trial counsel also improperly admitted all the culpability phase evidence without making a determination as to relevancy, and allow the jury to consider the relevance. So that also further confused the issues between the culpability phase and the mitigation phase of the trial. The trial court's instruction on the culpability phase evidence was extremely confusing. This is from the transcript, page 2321. The court has not excluded from your consideration any of the trial phase evidence, but you may only consider evidence relevant to the aggravating circumstances. So when we look at, again, the jury instructions as a whole, the fact that this B3 factor was given, that it was given over defense counsel's objection, that other statutory factors were omitted despite the fact that there was evidence in the record. We look at what the trial court did with that very evidence, which is what defense counsel was concerned about. And we look at, it's reasonably likely that the jury was not able to give weight to the significant mitigating evidence present in this case. This is a case where the jury on one of the two victims was not able to reach a death verdict and a life sentence was imposed. So that says that there was mitigation present in this case, and there would have been even more so had the jury been properly instructed on how to consider the evidence of Mr. Garrett's character, history, and background, including his mental illness.
But doesn't the fact that there was a life sentence for one and not the other show that it was considered?
Well, the state actually specifically argued that the mitigating evidence couldn't be considered, and I know that's not dispositive of the issue, but they argued to the jury that because the evidence was so close to the NGRI defense that the jury shouldn't even consider it when looking at count two, which was the death of CD, which is what Mr. Garrett received the death sentence for. Also, there was a difference in the number of aggravating circumstances. The victim that he received the life verdict on, there was only one aggravating circumstance, which was a course of conduct. For the other victim, there were three. So if any bit of mitigating evidence that could have gone towards mitigating that other verdict would have been important in this case. The jurors are supposed to weigh the evidence cumulatively. So that's at least one more factor, the B5 not being instructed, and then the B3, which shouldn't have been there to begin with. And so the jury had weighed, a significant aggravating circumstance course of conduct. And when they've found the aggravating circumstances did not outweigh the mitigating factors in that case. The trial court opinion, as I mentioned, is evidence of how the jury likely heard the instruction as to the mental health evidence. And there were other serious issues with the trial court's opinion as well. The trial court didn't do that cumulative analysis of the mitigating factors. It held the mitigating factors up one by one, and in fact completely flipped the burden and said that each mitigating factor, which it only found two, it weighed independently and said it did not outweigh the aggravating circumstances in the case. So we don't have that additional safeguard here of the trial court doing its own assessment following the jury's verdict to make sure that was properly imposed. Bipolar disorder is a serious and major mental illness, as this court's recognized, and by the recently enacted legislation exempting defendants with serious mental illness from the death penalty. That statute was not enacted before Mr. Garrett's trial, but nevertheless, it shows the importance of that mitigating factor, and that the jury should have been able to properly consider it in this case. There's no more questions at this time. I'd just like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'll start with the first proposition of law involving the B3 mitigator. The first point I want to make is that this issue was not properly preserved. When they're talking about the instructions, this is about halfway through the mitigation hearing after a couple witnesses had already testified, and after the defense had talked about mental health extensively in the opening statement, the defense said that for the first time that they were not requesting a B3 mitigation instruction. This caught everybody by surprise. And the prosecutor made the point that, well, you've already mentioned it in opening statement. You've already actually admitted Defense Exhibit 1, which is the full NGRI report. And the trial judge even asked the defense attorney, well, can you explain this? Why are you not requesting the B3 mitigator instruction? And the defense said, well, we're not requesting it, but we're just going to leave it to the court's discretion. And there's some more back and forth, and ultimately they did say, we are not requesting it, but they never raised an objection. And they only described strategic reasons for why they did not want that instruction. Now, I think there's a difference between requesting something based on strategic reasons versus actually raising an objection and conveying to the court that there is a legal reason for the request that you're making. In fact, Criminal Rule 30 talks about how an objection to jury instructions must state the grounds for the objection. And I don't think that there was a full-fledged objection here, just a strategy decision by the counsel to not ask for that B3 mitigating instruction. So based
counsel.
On that.
Counsel, I'd like to be clear whether there was an objection or not, or waiver or forfeiture. Is it your position, though, that the trial court got it right in giving the B3 instruction?
Yes.
All right. With that, presumably, even though the defense did not request a B3 instruction, the court found itself duty-bound to, in fact, give it because the evidence would suggest that it was duty-bound and necessary to give. Using that same logic, there's argument that B5 should have been given. The appellant is making that argument, and so I wonder, how does that square? So if the trial court came to the conclusion that despite the fact the defendant did not request the B3, I am duty-bound to give it, it would seem to me that the same logic should have been used with respect to the B5.
The difference between the B3 issue and the B5 issue is that on the B3 issue, you have a party specifically requesting the instruction, that being the state. On the B5 issue, nobody requested the instruction.
All right, but isn't the real issue whether or not the evidence requires that trial court judge to give the instruction? I understand sometimes in the heat of a trial, some strategically or otherwise will make a request or not make a request, but separate and apart from that, the judge is required to give an instruction consistent with how the evidence came through. How do you square that?
I agree that judges should give instructions when they're supported by the evidence, but the parties still play a role in forming the jury instructions. The parties have to preserve issues for proper appellate review. It's up to the parties to request specific instructions if they want one. So, to be clear, I think based on this record, based on the email the judge sent out after the jury issued its recommendation, I think it's pretty clear that had either one of the parties requested a B5 instruction, the judge would have given it, to be fair. But neither party requested that instruction, so on the second proposition of law, we are limited to plain air review because of that. And the Goff case that the judge cited is dispositive on this. In the Goff case, the exact same issue happened. The defense presented evidence on certain mitigators. The judge did not instruct on those mitigators. And the judge, or this court, said that there was no reversible error there because the evidence was presented and the judge's instructions made it clear to the jury that they could consider that evidence as mitigating, and we have that here as well on the lack of record mitigator. It was presented, and during the opening, it was presented as evidence. The judge gave an instruction on the history, character, and background under subsection B. The judge gave further instructions saying that the jury was required to consider all mitigating evidence. So, if nothing else, we know for a fact that the absence, and I should say that the state did not dispute the absence of a record. I mean, there was nothing to dispute. That's an objective fact. The defendant did not have a record. And the defense talks about how, in other cases, the state was agreeing to mitigation. I don't read Goff that way. I don't read Goff as the state was agreeing to mitigation. But in any event, in this case, no one was disputing that the defendant did not have a record. There is evidence to that effect. The judge instructed the jury to consider the history, character, and background of the defendant. The judge instructed the jury to consider all mitigating evidence. And so, if nothing else, we know that the absence of record made its way onto the scale, so to speak. The jury considered that and just chose not to give any or little mitigating weight to it.
What we don't know, though, we can speculate and argue as to the probability that the jury did consider the lack of a criminal record, lack of a criminal background, but we don't know that because there was no instruction by the judge as to you shall consider as a mitigating factor. And so that is where I see the logic being inconsistent with the judge deciding to give the B3 instruction as opposed to the B5 instruction.
I'll just point, Your Honor, to the Goff decision again, and this is citing Buchanan versus Angelone, and it says that when you have evidence of a mitigator that's presented, and we have that here, we have the evidence was undisputed in this case, and you have instructions involving history, character, and background, and you have instructions saying that the jury is required to consider all mitigating evidence, the Goff case says it's unlikely the jury disregarded that evidence. So even though there is no specific instruction on B5, I just don't think, it's certainly not enough to overcome plain error review, I don't think we can say on this record that the jury somehow thought that the absence of record was not a mitigator. Everyone seemed to agree that it should be on the scale. The question was just how much weight was a jury going to give it. And I don't think giving a specific B5 instruction would have caused the jury to somehow give that lack of a record more weight than it would have given under the history, character, background instruction or a catch-all instruction. We know it was on the scale. We know it was considered. It's just a matter of how much weight was it going to receive, and I don't think, certainly not in plain error review, which we're in here, that a B5 instruction would have caused a jury to give it more weight than it would have given under the other instructions. Returning to the B3 issue, the defense is correct under DePue that the defendant has wide latitude to raise mitigating factors. They don't have wide latitude to veto judges' instructions that are requested by the state. The defense here did, in fact, raise a B3 mitigator, whether they like to admit it or not, they raised it. They talked about mental health during the opening statement, and more importantly, they admitted the NGRI report as evidence. So when you admit that NGRI report as evidence, you are necessarily raising a B3 mitigator, whether you like it or not. I cite a variety of cases in the brief regarding the interplay between the NGRI defense and the B3 mitigator. The cases seem to come at this from two different directions. On the one hand, you have cases like Cooey and Greer and Dickerson, where the defendant raises a B3 mitigator and then doesn't want the jury to consider NGRI evidence. And this court says, no, the NGRI evidence is relevant to the B3 mitigator, so you can't prevent the jury from considering the NGRI evidence. So that just shows how the NGRI evidence is relevant to the B3 mitigator. So when you admit an NGRI report, you are necessarily raising the B3 mitigator. The other direction that these cases take this issue from is illustrated in the Garner case, which I think is actually more instructive here. In the Garner case, the defendant raised the B3 mitigator, started to put on some expert evidence about his mental health, and then realized that the evidence wasn't going so well for him, and then tried to withdraw the B3 mitigator halfway through the mitigation hearing. And this court said, no, you can't do that. Once you raise it, you can't control the court's instructions. You don't have a veto authority over instructions by the court. And I think that's where we are here. The defense raised the B3 mitigator. They they admitted the NGRI report. They don't get to veto instructions by the court, especially when they're specifically requested by the state. There was some talk earlier about how the prosecutor had argued that the jury should not consider mental health evidence. I don't read the prosecutor's argument to be that. I think the prosecutor was arguing that the mental health evidence was not deserving of very much weight, which is fair argument, but I don't see the prosecutor saying they can't even consider the mental health evidence. It's just the opposite. Everyone agreed that the mental health, the NGRI report was admissible, and no one was disputing that it at least had to be considered by the jury. I want to talk a little bit also about the 10th proposition of law, because it was touched on a little bit earlier about the prosecution's admission of the guilt phase evidence into the mitigation hearing. Again, I think we are in invited error mode here, not just plain error, but invited error mode here, because on page 2095 of the transcript, the prosecutor moved to admit the guilt phase evidence. The judge specifically asked the defense if they had any objection, and the defense said no. That is affirmatively consenting to a proposed procedure that amounts to invited error. That's different from an after-the-fact acquiescence or simply not saying anything at all, which would result in a forfeiture. But when the prosecutor is proposing something and the judge asks the defense, do you have an objection, and you affirmatively say no objection, that's an affirmative consent to the procedure, so that would be invited error. So I don't think this issue deserves any review at all. At the very least, it would be forfeited for plain error, and the defendant cannot show plain error because all of the mitigating evidence was relevant to the aggravating, or pardon me, all of the guilt phase evidence was relevant to the aggravating circumstances insofar as two of the aggravators, the course of conduct aggravator and the under 13 aggravator, both required purpose to kill. The course of conduct aggravator required purpose to kill two or more people, which means proof that the defendant purposely killed Nicole and also purposely killed the young child. And that would rope in just about all the evidence from the guilt phase. We're talking about how the murders were committed, the nature of the injuries, the defendant's statements during his interview, his consciousness of guilt afterwards, the events leading up to the murders. All that was relevant to purpose to kill, at least with respect to the two victims. So that's all relevant to the course of conduct aggravator. The under 13 aggravator also has a purpose to kill element in it. So all that guilt phase evidence would come in to prove the purpose element of the aggravators. The defense seems to think that in the reply briefing, the defense argues that, well, you know, only small portions of the evidence are really relevant to the aggravators. You know, when you're talking about the aggravating circumstances, you can kind of break off certain small chunks of the evidence and only admit that. Given the purpose element that is in those two aggravating circumstances, I just don't think that that's feasible here. You have to admit the entire guilt phase evidence to prove the purpose element. And again, this was invited error, or at the very least, it was plain error. So the admission of the guilt phase evidence wouldn't amount to reversible error either. At the end of the day, the defendant doesn't show any reversible error. Many of the arguments are either invited or forfeited, and unless the court has any questions, I would just ask the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Under Ohio law, the state does not get to request instructions on mitigation. That is flat out in violation of DePue. This court would have to overrule the case to adopt the state's point. And the state didn't argue that B3 was mitigating. So even if we accepted that the state could say, well, we're requesting this instruction, they argued against the application of that mitigator during closing argument. So how does it make any sense to let the state determine the mitigating evidence that the defendant is going to have the burden of putting before the jury? The state said that nothing was on the scale. They didn't concede that the prior history was mitigating. They didn't concede that he didn't have a prior record, that that fact was true. They just never addressed it. They didn't read the factors to the jury and include the B5 in there and say, this is a mitigating factor, it's up to you to determine the weight. That never happened in this case. The trial court didn't give that instruction either. So as defense counsel even said, talking about the B3 instruction, these things are in the statute for a reason. They're in the statute because the legislature thought this was important, and it needs to be considered when you're determining whether you're going to give someone a death sentence or not. You know, that's not what happened here. This case is different than Garner. In Garner, defense counsel requested the instruction. Then they tried to pull that back and asked the jury, the court, not to instruct the jury on it. That's not what happened here. Defense from the outset of the case, from pretrial motion, said, we want you to only instruct on the factors that we raise at trial. The court granted that motion, citing DePue. The court, when it was preparing the final instructions and looking at proposed instructions from the state, said it was going to review those rulings that it had made previously. There's no need to file additional motions if you don't have additional case law. And it's not until after mitigation has started that the court is going over the instructions with counsel, and defense counsel said, we don't want this raised. That was in accordance with the trial court's earlier ruling.
Counsel, I pushed on the appellee, so I'm going to push on you a little bit. It seems as though we want to selectively use one rationale for the B3 and not use the same rationale for the B5. And so if my recollection is correct from the record, defense did not request the B5, correct?
Correct.
So if you didn't request the B5 but now are arguing judge should have given the B5, how do you make that same argument with respect to you didn't request the B3, but you've got a problem with the judge giving the B3 instruction? How do you square that?
Well, we tried to square that in our brief by raising defense counsel's failure to request the instruction as ineffective assistance of counsel. So we believe that counsel should have requested the B5 instruction and that it was deficient and prejudicial when they did not do that. It's still the trial court's error in not giving that instruction because counsel had argued and presented evidence to that effect. But it still was, the defense was putting that at issue as a mitigating factor in the case, and therefore that instruction should have been given. Like in Garner, I was just saying, defense raised the instruction and tried to take it back, and that's not what happened here. They never mentioned B3. They never mentioned it in their opening. They talked about the psychological history, but they wanted to distinguish that from being held up against the B3 criteria. And the trial court ultimately understood that trial counsel was objecting to the B3 objection. After he read the instructions to the jury, he once again met with counsel, and counsel once again said, we did not request that, and the trial court says, I note your objection for the record. So if the purpose is of an objection is to let the trial court rule on the issue in the first instance, the trial court did that here. He just disregarded counsel's clear request to not give that instruction. Now, as I said, you know, the state didn't concede that anything was mitigating in this case. This was not an issue of them saying you need to determine how much weight is given. They specifically referenced the mental health evidence as they didn't think it was even relevant at all to the first victim, to count one. So this isn't a case where, you know, the jury surely understood that it was to consider the mental health evidence in one way, but just decided against that. Those aren't the circumstances here. You know, the unique circumstances of mitigation are such that it is the defendant's right to decide what evidence he's going to present in favor of saving his life. And there was significant mitigation evidence here that the jury wasn't able to consider, and the trial court ultimately didn't consider in its sentencing opinion either. If Ohio is going to allow the death penalty, it has to be administered fairly. And there's no way that we can look at what happened overall in the sentencing hearing of this case and determine that there was a fair and reliable outcome. even if we're looking at things that weren't objected to, I don't believe that acquiescing to something is the same as invited error, but we look at the context of the jury instructions as a whole and what the trial court did in its opinion. There's no indicia of reliability and fairness in this case. Unless there's any further questions, I just ask this court to reverse and remand.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.